What you're referencing is the 18th surah of the Quran, wherein Khidr is actually not explicitly called Khidr. He is sort of this mysterious stranger that the prophet Moses, or Musa in Arabic, encounters in this intermediary or liminary dimension, which is oftentimes referred to as the Barzakh, which in other parts of the Quran is described as a sort of isthmus, specifically in Surah Ar-Rahman, this isthmus between two waters, oftentimes also conceived of as salt water and fresh water. But you could just boil that down to a liminal space in general. And this surah in particular, the 18th, Al-Kahf, which is the cave, is divided up into three sections, which are all related to one another in a way, and all in many respects dealing with boundaries, boundary erecting, boundary dissolving. Tombs or grave sites are considered to be barzakh, liminal places between life and death. And many places that Khidr is associated with are also tombs and places of death. Yet this is a figure of verdancy, right? We associate greenness and we associate life with this figure, hence why we're speaking about him on the verge of the spring equinox as, as this green man, right? So what is this paradox between the figure who greens the land with every step that he takes, as well as he is not incarnate. He is in some way, in many ways, of the other world.
Hello, and welcome to the Spirit Box podcast, where we explore folklore, magic, the world of the spirits, and everything in between. Today we are joined by J.M. Hamid on the subject of Al-Qadir. J.M. Hamid is an interdisciplinary artist, astrologer, writer, and educator residing in New York City. Focusing on the aesthetics of esoterica and the occult, their work bridges contemporary artistic practice with archaic forms of knowing. They have lectured, exhibited, and enacted live performances in the conjuration of phantom forms and ritual magic. Al-Qadir is a figure described but not mentioned by name in the Quran. As a righteous servant of God possessing great wisdom or mystical knowledge, in various Islamic and non-Islamic traditions, Qadir is described as a messenger who guards the sea, teaches secret knowledge, and aids those in distress. The meaning of the name has traditionally been taken to be the Green One or the Verdant One, which connects him to folkloric figures such as the Green Man and the spirits of spring and of greening. We discuss Qadir's liminal nature and his role as guide and get into some of the really interesting folkloric and magical synchronicities surrounding the North Pole. In the Plus Show, we discuss Qadir's association with being two-horned and Moses also being depicted with two horns. We get into the ideas around the non-human language of nature and what Qadir as a spirit of creativity means to our guest. To close, we get into the similarities between Qadir and Krishna. If you want to hear the Plus Show, it's very simple to do so. Simply join the Patreon and get the entire Plus Show back catalogue and all the bonus show extras. And if you're watching this on YouTube or any other video platform, remember to hit like and subscribe. Right, let's get on with the show. J.M. Hamid, you're very welcome back to the Spirit Box.
Yay. Nice to see you. So happy to be back.
That's great to see you. It'd be nice to have you back on the show. And today we're going to talk about a topic when did we start discussing this? It might have been just after the last time you were on.
I think we might have even touched on it briefly when I was on the last time. At least, I know I talked about Zohar a little bit and these tenuous threads, and Khidr is connected to this, I know we've been wanting to do this for a while,
Well, it's lovely to get the opportunity to do so, and for those of you who are wondering what the hell we're actually talking about, you need to correct my pronunciation all the way through, by the way. One or two times may suffice, but we're talking about kind of Al-Qadir, and this huge, yet
relatively unknown figure within Islam.
A vast topic, and in the same way of pulling on threads, you can keep pulling on this thread endlessly, because Khidr in his very nature, Khidr being just green, the Arabic word essentially for green or verdancy, but in his nature as a sort of Hermes-like mercurial figure in many respects, you can keep pulling on those threads, and those threads will always lead you in a different direction, and that is just his very nature. And in that way, speaking about him as a topic becomes this sort of vast, never-ending, rambly adventure. I was on another podcast recently, which will be coming out soon, like talking about Khidr. I always end up in this like almost strange trance-like state where I'm like, wait, what am I even talking about now? Which is also very like him, because you know, I want to touch on as many facets as I can about this figure today, including not just his more orthodox Islamic, like Khidr in the Arabic or Muslim sense, but also in the way he manifests as the quote unquote green man, let's say, in other traditions, this figure of the spring returning out of the death that is winter, which, you know, many cultures hold dear. And in this way, once again, this is why it becomes such a vast topic of like, that does apply to so many cultures and so many traditions. So I want to be able to cover all those things, as well as, I know a little before the show, we were also talking about the way this connects with things that you've been going through and writing about, as well as so many other things in our lives. But yeah, Khidr is a fascinating figure. And like, as you said, not particularly well known, or maybe he's so well known that he's actually not well known, something like that.
Well, I mean, I think that would probably fit quite well with his nature. I mean, so some of the areas, the kind of more conventional areas that I'm familiar with him are kind of like in the what I would describe as kind of the parable type stories, where his actions seem to go against his message. And then the person accompanying him starts to understand after the fact that actually his actions were totally correct. They seem to be completely immoral kind of initial observance, but then kind of when more information arises, that becomes actually his actions were totally moral. You know, like in, I think it's one story, like where he rewards inhospitality with repairing a wall, and there's other kind of things like that. And then he kills, I think he was accompanied by Moses at some stage, and he kills a young man, and Moses is dismayed, and then more information kind of comes up. It's a big test, so, you know, obviously, like all these things, the spirits don't ever want to hang out. Spirits at this level they always want to test you. It's like endless.
Why
tests.
Couldn't it ever just be simple? Yeah. Can we just be like relaxing on a nice couch? And I mean, there's things like that in the Quran of like, oh, you know, paradise is just like really nice couches and flowing water and things like that.
Yeah.
It's not that way with Khidr whatsoever. I mean, what you're referencing is the 18th surah of the Quran, wherein Khidr is actually not explicitly called Khidr.
Yeah.
He is sort of this mysterious stranger that the prophet Moses, or Musa in Arabic, encounters in this intermediary or liminary dimension, which is oftentimes referred to as the Barzakh, which in other parts of the Quran is described as a sort of isthmus, specifically in Surah Ar-Rahman, this isthmus between two waters, oftentimes also conceived of as salt water and fresh water. But you could just boil that down to a liminal space in general.
Yeah.
And this surah in particular, the 18th, Al-Kahf, which is the cave, is divided up into three sections, which are all related to one another in a way, and all in many respects dealing with boundaries, boundary erecting, boundary dissolving, as well as the beginning of the surah, a reference to what seems to be older medieval Christian stories about a group of young boys who were fleeing the Roman army and ended up in a cave and became lost in this cave for, there isn't an agreed upon number of years, but typically hundreds of years, wherein they fall asleep and they come out hundreds of years later. So already before we encounter Khidr in the Quran, or at least as the exegetical literature comes out later to describe this figure as Khidr, you're already dealing with this lost time phenomena, right? Almost this like UFO abducted sense of like, you went into this place, this mysterious place, and you came out hundreds of years later and the time was lost. This is the going to the cave is the first section of the surah, which then leads into the story between Moses and Khidr, where Moses is, he's looking for this fish that he brought with him to eat. And it's not really clear whether this fish is alive or dead, but he's chasing this fish and he's following this fish. And eventually he encounters this mysterious figure who he wishes to learn from. And Khidr is like, I don't know if you have the patience to learn from me. This is as you're referencing, like, and so he says, just follow me and basically see if you can keep up. And Moses is like, I got this. And so they go through these different ordeals or scenarios, three, as you mentioned, I believe two of them, the first one being the scuttling of a ship, the second one being him killing a boy, and then the last one being this fixing of a wall without receiving pay. And in each instance, Moses raises the moral quandary of like, well, how could you do this thing? And Khidr is like, I told you to have patience in me, have patience and see where this goes. And by the end of it, they both sort of become fed up, and Khidr is like, well, you didn't really have patience as I asked you to, so let me basically explain all of this. And in this almost like Nietzschean beyond good and evil way, Khidr's like, no, if you could just see through the binary of the situation, you would see that actually I did all of these things for a reason, wherein the situation ended up working out for the best in the end. That's I don't want to go through all the specific details. I don't think it's necessary. If people are interested in this, is the 18th surah of the Quran, the cave. And they can read it. But this is the most important iteration or story of Khidr in an Islamic sense, and where most of the hadith and the exegesis emerges from. Of course, there are other stories that are related to it. I'm sure we'll talk about later in the show, but even things in, for example, the Babylonian Talmud, where there are stories of King Solomon sending one of his viziers to retrieve the demon Asmodeus, and the interaction between Asmodeus or Asmodai and King Solomon's vizier almost mirrors to the exact story the relationship between Moses and Khidr.
Right.
In this way. So there are flavors of this throughout other traditions and manifesting in other ways for sure. But I in this tradition in particular, it is worth mentioning while I'm talking about the 18th surah of the Quran, that the third primary story is that of a figure known as Dhul-Qarnayn, who is often translated as he of the two horns. And This story is perhaps a little bit more directly related to Khidr and a lot of the esoteric lore that comes out of this particular surah. And it talks about his travels from one end of the earth to the other end of the earth, the land of the rising and the setting sun on both ends of it. You could even think about it, the two sides of the horn that is, you know, this great bowl that is the moon or something as such. And in his encounters, he encounters a group of people who do not understand his language between two mountains. This is another realm of Barsakh, of liminal space. Right. Between worlds, similar to Khidr's encounter, but more in the case of land as opposed to water. It's not following the swimming fish in this way. And this is a place where the people are being tormented by the figures of Yajuj and Majuj, who are Gog and Magog in the Bible. And these people are like, Dhul-Qarnayn, please erect a wall between us so that we will no longer be tormented by these beings which are harassing us. And he does this out of iron or hadid, which is its own surah in the Quran 57. But he says that on the day of judgment, when the horn of Israfil blows, that this wall will be reduced, and the flood of spirits will come through, and those who are disbelievers will experience hell in an imminent way on the day of judgment. So this entire surah is filled with visionary, it's much like Revelations in the Bible, right, for example, filled with visionary imagery and filled with rich eschatological kind of writing, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so much of the lore really comes from this one particular chapter, especially in Islam.
That's fascinating. Really, really fascinating. And then I think one of the really stunning things I find about Qadir within Islam is that there's space made for this being. There's ideological, theological space made to accommodate the being, where, you know, it's not quite a saint, but it's also kind of not quite an angel. But there's kind of all these different components that go up to make this being. And you see that when you kind of look at the information surrounding Qadir, and that's, say, folkloric, where it's there's syncretic kind of beliefs around other aspects of Qadir. That there's something liminal, fundamentally liminal about the being.
Exactly. And people not being able to agree on what he or they are, yes, is testament to this exactly. And I mean, and I'm not equating the two by any means, but he is similar to the figure of Iblis in this way.
Yes.
There is so much theological debate around whether Iblis, who is essentially the Islamic Lucifer, or mm-hmm. Satan, whether this being is a jinn or an angel. And this is something that theologians went back and forth on for a while, and is never, it's one of those things that's just never going to have a unanimous decision in a way. But Khidr is similar. Many people have sort of gone back and forth on whether he is a saint or a prophet. And this is a distinction that I'm very much interested in, especially with this notion of saints as dead people who also do not fully transition over into death and kind of remain in this way, assisting people who call on them. Once again, this debate happens with Khidr and is never something that will be solidified or concrete by any means, per the nature of Khidr, mm-hmm. as we've mentioned. But it's interesting that so many shrines that are associated with Khidr are actually tombs as well. And I would be remiss not to mention, not to get all pluggy about it, but I did teach a class for the Cauldron Black's Mighty Dead series, where I really tried to get into this liminal quality Khidr has between life and death. His dwelling place being the Barzakh, this place between life and death, and him as a figure who is the one who walks between these lines. Mm-hmm. but the tombs or grave sites are considered to be barzakh, liminal places between right. life and death. And many places that Khidr is associated with are also tombs and places of death. Yet this is a figure of verdancy, right? We associate greenness and we associate life with this figure, hence why we're speaking about him on the verge of the spring equinox as, yes. as this green man, right? So what is this paradox between the figure who greens the land with every step that he takes, as well as he is not incarnate. He is in some way, in many ways, of the other world. Mm-hmm. He is dead in many respects. Once again, this figure who embodies this paradox. Everything about him is paradoxical. One yeah. more reason why he is so much a challenge to
yeah.
talk about.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's interesting to note when you talk about kind of the idea of paradox, and one idea that I see kind of alongside of that when you look at these type of figures is their very existence or how they present or the epithets that they acquire are in themselves metaphors for non-duality. You know, that they're just encoded within their very being. And everything that kind of orbits around them. And as an aside, we'll see what direction this goes in. But one of the things I dug up in my research into the Dark Man, the Witch Father, is the second most prominent figure that presented to witches that's documented from the Scottish Witch Database, which has indexed and listed all the court cases and testimonies that were on record. The second most prominent figure that turns up, this is from my research, so don't go looking for anybody else's and going, where exactly is that figure? Because I've come up with this. So, exactly. Yes. Take it with a pinch of salt, you know. But what I found from my research, because I was specifically looking for accounts where the pattern of the Dark Man would appear, but the second most prominent one was a man all in green appearing to the Scottish peasantry, which could be a by the by, could be nothing at all. But it did, and I will be honest, it made me think at the time, it's like, is that Al Qadir?
Is that you? Hey, what's up, man?
but, it, you know, given the kind of there is some sects of witchcraft that do have a mythos around Qadir. Who knows?
Please correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that it is canonical that certain fairies manifest with the color green or are associated with the color green. That's yeah. correct, right?
Yes, absolutely.
As yeah. well as I've heard white, yeah. And I guess other the color correspondence is its own thing.
Yeah,
I mean, green is a sacred color, the most sacred color in Islam, and you could reduce that to, well, these are people of largely desert cultures, right? So of course, green is going to be a sacred color. Islam is Venus and in the Picatrix, and I mean, there's so many like little inroads you could take into that. But this is. I do think that this is a color of spirits, a color that spirits, especially of this ilk, hold sacred. In referring to the dwelling places of not only figures like Khidr, but Khidr himself, he is thought to dwell on this mountain or this realm referred to as Mount Kof, which is the Arabic letter Kof,
yes.
Which is a reference to the nape of the neck. Which mm-hmm. I think I actually might have spoken about this last time I was on your show, interestingly enough, because this is a point that many traditions, spirits are thought to possess through the nape of the neck. And this is also the division between the head and the body, right? Mm-hmm. It is its own liminal place
yeah.
between the entirety of consciousness or embodied being. But this mountain, Mount Kof, is considered to be the Emerald Mountain. This is not only the realm of the Jinn in particular. This is the home and the residence of Jinn, as well as, you know, the varieties of mythical creatures amongst Persia and Middle Eastern culture and whatnot. So this is Khidr's dimension. And this is it has this green glow to it. I you know, the fact that people see this kind of greenness in these sorts of encounters, I don't think that that's by accident or coincidence.
Yeah, the Mount Kof stuff is amazing. I mean, I just listening to you, I realize I've been mispronouncing it for about 4 years now, but move on from that.
No worries.
But yeah, the whole concept as well of like things like the Northern Lights, where at one stage believed to be the reflection of Mount Kof, you know, up into the heavens. There's so much lore surrounding that area of the world that it gets me to a point where I think there has to be something beyond, like, say, migration of ideas, to have that kind of completely ingrained cultural belief in so many areas. It's like, so for example, in England or in Western European tradition, the same mountain's called Rupus Nigre, right? And it's believed to be kind of the Black Mountain, right? The mountain of entire lodestone, which is why every compass points north, you know. And in Irish lore, you have the Tuatha De Danann. So the tribe of gods who become the fairies and who have godlike qualities, all this kind of stuff, came from the north, from four cities in the north, where they learned arts of occult and witchcraft and science and all this kind of stuff. Brought their gifts, the cauldron, the plenty, the various different kind of tokens that are totems that make up kind of Celtic or Gaelic lore, rather. Come from these four cities in the north. But then when you look at the Rupus Nigre idea, it's like the idea of four islands in the north, you know, around the mountain. And it's so interesting that you've got these different areas of the world.
There's just so much, even like the proper word? The ambivalence with these kinds of spirits and iron. They were, you know, speaking about iron, its relationship to fairies and similar spirits, and also how in the Quran the meteoric iron is thought to, you know, come down from the heavens, these falling stars, and this iron is used as an aid for humanity. And this is the same iron that Dhul-Qarnayn, you know, erects as this division between these different dimensions. But you know, as we're speaking about, like, is this actually something that's causing a is it more divisive, or is it actually there's a lot of ambivalence around this, and like, is it actually as much of a ward as maybe we think it is? These things that come from the north. I feel like it's important to reference it because we were speaking about it before we hit record, but you brought up again these witchcraft traditions which mention Khidr-like figures, and we're talking about the clan of Tubal-Cain and the work of Chumbly, and the connection between more quote-unquote Western and Eastern traditions. And it can be absolutely hard to parse out what is just plain appropriation or the available material to these writers at the time, and what they're using to simply bolster their own frameworks as opposed to tapping into, you know, the root of something. But especially in this relationship with the north, for example, we talked about Chumley, his kutub, or it's not his kutub, or his referencing of the Sufic notion of kutub or the pole, which leads one to the north and is the pathway to the Emerald Mountain as well, which, whether it be shamanic lore or witch lore, this vertical dimension that beings who are endowed with these kinds of abilities, let's say, they're traveling up through the hole in the sky into the northerly regions through flight, this is no different, I think. Yes. And this is something, these underlying, I don't know if you want to call them mythological, folk beliefs, religious beliefs, what have you, these are things that are shared Eastern, Western, across cultures over many thousands of years. It's been really, really great to get deeper into the astrological connections on my end. You had Sasha Ravitch on recently, and her and I are working on something having to do with these different sky quadrants, these different courts associated with the four royal stars. And Khidr as a figure, as we're talking about him being associated with water, being associated with rebirth, well, these are the signs of the northerly sky quadrant, which in the system that Sasha has been working through, as I mentioned, with these four royal stars, would be associated with the star Fomalhaut, the mouth of the fish, or the entranceway to the mouth of the whale.
Right.
Which has so much lore around it, a primary story being Jonah and the whale, and this being another form of Barzakh, or the entrance into the liminal, as yeah. Jonah is in the mouth of this great beast and is brought to the bottom of the ocean in this liminal space, similar to Khidr in the cave.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, whether it be the relationship to water, to the winter time and the spring, which emerges out of the death that is the winter, this northerly region in Sasha's system associated with Fomalhaut, but in the Chinese Lunar Mansion system associated with the black tortoise of the black turtle of the north, who is entwined by a serpent. And interestingly enough, to many of the things that you are interested in, the presiding deity is thought to be this dark man, sometimes referred to as the dark warrior, or just this mysterious dark god who is always sort of obscured and not particularly knowable, who rules the northerly dimension that all of this stuff, you know, the stars are raining down. And in this very Book of Enoch sort of way, like the beings who emerge down from this dimension are teaching us these sciences and crafts and arts and whatnot, and so much related to everything we're talking about.
That's really interesting. And it's so interesting you mention the Book of Enoch as well. As like in the Book of Adam and Eve, there's a passage where Satan propositions Adam and Eve to come to his garden in the north. You know, I think that they don't go for it, but he propositions Cain sometimes later. I think that works out slightly better from memory.
Come to my garden.
Lovely place, just north of here.
Yeah.
But he talks about kind of where his garden in the north, where he, I'm trying to reach into my memory for the quote, but it's something along the lines of where my people are, my relatives are, in this garden in the far north. And it's such an interesting thing that you have another line, another kind of like narrative point of connection, where you do get this crossover point of all these different narratives coming together in our northern regions. It's extraordinary.
Well, who surrounds the seemingly but not so actually fixed point of the pole? The same pole as the constellation of Draco, right? This is the serpent who is entwined around the northerly regions in this way. This is the serpent in the tree in the garden.
Mm.
And you know, this very Chinese reference to the serpent entwined around the turtle being in this is my understanding of it, or this is my interpretation of it, the turtle being representative of this fixed point, being a creature who moves yet with fixity, a reference to the Dhruva, or the pole point, which has this very nature, and the serpent wrapped around, and the deity who resides here, this dark god, In the same way that the axial dimension, you can never really reach it because it's always at the center of everything. Mm-hmm. It's always behind what is visible. It is always esoteric. Mm-hmm. But this is what Khidr teaches. In his manifestation in Islam, less in what would be referred to as more the heretical understanding, even though it would be interpreted as heretical by many.
Right.
But he is the one who teaches how to move into this interior dimension where you may traverse this pathway to the north, which is also in internal to each of us, which is also the esoteric path that is accessible to each and every one of us. Yeah. Through moving into our interior. I think you would appreciate this. I was talking about this on another podcast recently, and revisiting Ibn Arabi's understanding of the jinn. Mm-hmm. And he goes as far to, I mean, he's sort of playing with etymology and ideas. It isn't like a definitive thing for him, but he refers to all things which are hidden as jinn, including angels,
right?
Which that could be considered a heretical take, of course. In itself. But as a part of that, also our interior dimension, meaning our mind, our imagination, mm-hmm. this would also be jinn. And when God says in the Quran, this message is for humanity and the jinn, he is talking about the exterior of humanity, which is the exoteric, as well as our interior dimension, which is jinn, which is in, it's concealed, it's hidden away from us. So Khidr, as the teacher, as the one who can bring us and teach us how to access this dimension, although of course being fraught with much trial and challenge and the dangers of madness and everything else, is the one who may bring us closer to our jinn dimension.
Yeah.
To our inner Mount Kof, right? Into our inner Kutub or pole, which allows us to traverse the north, mm-hmm. right? In this way.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, that makes an awful lot of sense, and I think to build on that, there's equally there's a way to the cave as well internally, you know,
exactly,
and that's certainly kind of in my experience with the spirits I work with is certainly a thing, you know.
Even that was Carl Jung's hot take on Khidr, was like,
really?
Yeah, he's like, oh, the cave is our interior, is our our unconscious in psychoanalytic language, like, and Khidr being in the cave is, as we talked about, this 18th surah of the Quran. He's like, that's the one who brings you into the unconscious dimension. This is the guide in the unconscious realm. This is the Hermes as Psychopomp into the land of the dead and mm-hmm. and all of this.
Jung was really onto something. Like, he really was. Like, the more you look into Jung's stuff, like, he just seems to be so robust in his exploration into the esoteric.
He went pretty deep, that one, I will say.
Yeah.
Yeah. He had many faults, of course, as well. Yeah. But I just thought it was funny that even Jung had a take on Khidr. Like, he just finds his way into everything, and he truly like slips through every crack, and you know, you can find him under any stone and behind every tree, and I mean, he's truly so mysterious in that way. And I think that because he is so all pervasive, this is part of his such an important component to the spring mystery that he is in the sense of being the green man. Yeah. Like I think it is worth mentioning, especially because we wanted to do the show at this time, his connection with the figure of Elijah, and in many Eastern European countries and in the Middle East, there is the holiday, or the spring holiday of the Hizraleles, which is the meeting of Elijah and Khidr, who are, as it often goes with Khidr, either sometimes the same figure, wherein their shrine sites are oftentimes one and the same, or they are two figures, separate figures who are meeting together.
Right.
And it is their meeting, Elijah being, you know, the one in the Old Testament who defends the Hebrew God against the storm deity Baal, and the one who is capable of bringing fire down from heaven, a very much a fiery, stormy figure in himself, and Khidr being one of water, and the meeting of water and fire being the beginning of spring, the necessary elements, light, heat, warmth, fire, yeah, as well as water for life to emerge out of this. And this bring, I mean, his connection with Elijah is important once again, as these are two figures who are seen as one and the same sometimes. This same holiday happening in the Julian calendar on the day of Saint George, Jirgis, who is another figure who is also connected to Khidr, who George rides upon the horse. Mm-hmm. Khidr rides, is seen typically riding upon a fish, which is something I probably should have mentioned, but is, as I did say at the beginning, connected to the story where Moses is following this fish, mm-hmm, in this liminal world. And this relationship between the one who rides the animal or is part animal, and the sort of like the whether, you know, whether they're riding the animal or whether they are the animal, and this distinction is also fun and part of it, right?
Right.
And both George and Khidr not only representing fertility, of course, in this spring time point, but also being able to, in my conception of it, stir these serpentine or dragon forces of the natural world. So right, as Saint George takes his spear and spears pierces the dragon, this is how the verdancy is brought back from winter, because George as a figure is capable of restoring the same vertical dimension that we've been speaking of, right? Qutub, yep, or the pole, into these quote-unquote chaotic or ever-shifting forces of nature represented by the dragon or the, right, serpent. You see this in mythology across the board, in Tiamat and Marduk and so, yeah, on and so forth. Khidr is actually no different in this way. As a figure, he represents this axial dimension being brought to these ever-shifting forces of the natural world. And it is this ability to ride upon the fish or ride upon the horse, right, that allows these beings to not only move between worlds, but to also within these worlds both erect barriers and dissolve barriers, which is the story of Khidr, which is the story of Dhul-Qarnayn. I, like Ibn Arabi, also very much enjoy getting into the etymology and playing around with the words themselves, as the word khayl, which is horse, and khayali, which is imaginal or imagination, are very similar words. To ride upon the horse is to become closer, to be in contact with the imagination. And this is, I mean, something that I touched on a little bit in the last episode that I was on your show with Zohar. And kuf, which is the possession or the trance state brought upon by spirits, and the inspiration, which is thought to come from this state.
Yeah.
As it is said in many possession traditions, Afro-diasporic traditions in particular, that the spirit rides the human as their horse.
Yeah.
And in this way, whether we are in a state of poetry, whether we are in a state of majnun, which is a kind of possession, a poetic possession brought on by the jinn more than anything else, a kind of madness or explicit madness, this is also something that Khidr is related to, the madness of the poets. Because Khidr, once again, an important aspect of him is His connection with the elixir of immortality, which is the wine, the intoxicating substances that the poets consume to allow them to become closer to this dimension of immortality, right? And what they bring back from this journey into the cave, into the north, however you want to put it, is their poetry. And Khidr is the guide for the poets in this way. He is the one who allows for the spirits to come through and ride their horse, who is the poet, and bring the imaginal into the into physical manifestation, into this world, right? He is the allowance or the opening of the doors for prophecy, for poetry, for art, for beauty, and is the saint of the poets par excellence. You can't speak about Khidr without mentioning this. This is whether it's Hafez, whether it's Rumi, whether it's all of the most famous poets in the Sufi tradition, they have all been inspired by Khidr, every single one.
Oh, that's fantastic. How wonderful. Truly, truly interesting. When there's a certain word, and you might be able to help me with this, it's gone from my memory, but it's an Arabic word meaning God crazy. I think that's what it was. It might be an Egyptian word, but
I'm not too sure.
It's similar to, it's that exposure to the divine that makes people go crazy, basically, if they're not prepared for it. And I think it's something similar with exposure to these kind of you know, ultrally powerful, you know, spirits, where you're kind of touching the third rail with that. And even with just creativity, you know, which I think is that kind of subtler form of communication or spirit work, as opposed to, say, direct possession, you know, the ridden by a horse and then the slight gentle whispering in the ear or steering towards something. They're two separate things. But there is an impact. There is an impact on people, you know, and it does, you know, people get burnt out by that, you know, like if you're holding the spirit of illumination, it's going to burn you up a bit.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the poets and the soothsayers and whatnot have been looked upon as suspicious kind of characters for quite a long time in many different traditions and cultures. And this is once again that same, this is that access or that pipeline to this pretty much maddening. Whether it's a productive maddening is its own thing. You know, whether you can handle it, whether you can handle the light, the illumination is its own thing.
Yeah.
Which is why people need guides. Khidr just being one and a more challenging guide, because this is not an incarnate being.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, this is why these things have been looked upon as witchcraft, as trafficking with spirits. Even in an explicitly artistic or poetic context, where the difference between these things is more of a modern connotation.
Yeah.
You know, historically, spirit relationships and being inspired by the muses, or however you want to refer to that, went hand in hand with artistic inspiration. Art was not separate from, whether it's being inspired by God, as you're saying, even, you know, the beautiful artistry found in a Quran, in the calligraphy, in the line, or in the decoration and tile work of a mosque. Whether it's artistry inspired by the Almighty, Allah in a more totalizing sense, or even, you know, the particular being that is a jinn inspiring a poet. These things go hand in hand, right? And almost always have, except for our more secular understanding of what art and poetry may be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As you say, that's a relatively modern perspective. And the flip side of that is that with that gift becomes a, you know, there's a burden that some people have to manage. And it kind of reminds me, it goes back to that kind of stuff with Moses and Khidir and those initial kind of three stories, that it's a burden until you figure out what's going on. You know, where can you imagine what the internal world of Moses must have been like when he was traveling with Khidir? You know,
I mean, it's like, what the hell is going on?
What is this guy doing?
what? Yeah, like it's, and that's, once again, it's so easy to become lost in that, which is why it is almost rightfully looked upon in suspicious ways by people of a more orthodox bent. Like, mm-hmm. I sort of get it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's so easy to lose the way,
mm-hmm.
if that is the path you're trying to take. That is the, I mean, I say it jokingly, of course, you know, Khidr is like Nietzsche beyond good and evil or whatever. I say it tongue in cheek, but also that becomes weird, strange territory for anybody. And so it is important to remind folks listening that there is this emphasis with Khidr, especially in Ibn Arabi, where Khidr reminds him, Ibn Arabi being a very, very prominent, perhaps the most prominent Sufi esotericist, 13th century from Spain or southern Spain to have ever lived, at least in my mind. And Khidr was his primary teacher, as he is the teacher for so many on this path, on the esoteric path. And Khidr's reminder to Ibn Arabi to submit to his Sufi teachers, not to just submit to Khidr, but to submit to his incarnate teachers in this way, his human teachers,
right.
Which seems like, oh, you know, this is the guide of the esoteric path. And, you know, why is he reifying these very like normative relationships or whatever? Yeah. Like, isn't he supposed to be this rebellious figure or whatever? But no, I mean, there has to be this exoteric skeleton to hold together this ever this you know, maddening dimension of esoteric, mm-hmm. or spiritual exploration and all the things, mm-hmm. that come with that. And this is why Khidr is a guide as well, and not just one who is like tempting or challenging only.
Mm-hmm.
And so in this way, it is an important reminder that no, Khidr is not like a postmodern everything goes sort of figure, yeah. Also. And so I think that needs to be said, because, you know, people can oftentimes interpret these sorts of conversations and be like, oh, well, I'm going to try to get in contact with this figure for my own sort of ends, and this fits within my thing. It's like, that's not really what it is either. And that there does have to be this dimension of structure, because you don't want to be the one, the mad poet. That you know, people, we romanticize stuff like that. You don't want, I live in New York City. You don't want to be the mm-hmm. the babbling person on the subway, you know, just moving through and speaking in tongues and this sort of thing. Like, this is not to bring a heaviness or a gravitas to what I'm saying, but
no,
you know, correct. This is the sort of, yeah. stuff we're talking, yeah. about, right? So this is the emphasis on, you know, Khidr and the submission to the master in the Sufi path is the acknowledgement of this very reality, right? And how beautiful and tempting it is to overly romanticize this, but the acknowledgement that we need these structures,
mm-hmm.
we absolutely need these structures. We need to wear the right skins. To speak about it in more of a witchcraft angle, we need to wear the proper skins to be able to function in this world, but that doesn't just happen, right?
Mm-hmm. So as we're kind of wrapping up, what have you got going on?
I have a lot of very exciting things going on, some of which I'm keeping mostly under wraps until it is at least a little bit more manifest, mm-hmm. but I just put the podcast, A Star Night Dwell, back on all major podcast platforms, hoping to get new episodes out there as well as recently starting a Patreon for the podcast, as well as all of these esoteric musings, and so much more, as well as my art and talismanic practices. That is my website and the Patreon, as well as the podcast, or everything is Star Night Dwell, StarNightDwell on Twitter, Instagram. It's all my social media stuff. As I mentioned, doing this book with Sasha Ravitch, a previous guest on the show, much beloved by the both of us and by many of us. Mm-hmm. And very excited for that. So if you're interested in Sasha's work, follow that name. Maybe there'll be links. But I'm working on a book project with her in relationship to the stars. And I have a class coming up on the 25th with the Golden Dome School, who triangulate art, science, and mysticism together. They do wonderful, wonderful, wonderful classes, and it's run by incredible people, some of my best people. And this class is based on the lunar zodiac, which is a big, big part of my work. The mansions of the moon, if people are not familiar, and designing one's soul as well as interior space based on principles of the lunar zodiac. So their natal moon placement, going through the history of the lunar zodiac or the lunar mansions, and seeing how one's natal moon placement can become a creative tool for people, like we've been talking about, a means of inspiration through images, as well as designing your room a little bit better, like literal interior design. Yeah. So those are the main things going on for me right now.
Brilliant. Well, thank you. It's been really great chatting to you. I've enjoyed this conversation an awful lot. Some really great new things for me to explore now. I'm so fascinated by Moses's horns, and I'll
catch you. That's good, right? I'm gonna
have to go into that. That is amazing. Brilliant. Well, thank you very much. It's been lovely having you on the Spirit Box, and let's do it again soon.
Likewise. Let's, please.
Wonderful stuff. I hope you all enjoyed that. I certainly did. It was a great conversation. Hopefully we'll get J.M. Hamid back on the show relatively soon. If you want to find out more about J.M. Hamid's work, then do check the show notes for his website. Okay, that's it from me. I'm Dara Mason, and you've been listening to The Spirit Box. Take care and talk soon.